Thanks, Denis, for the introductions, but I guess I have to correct that. That seems to put you at a stage where you have a lot of expectation for this, which is not the right thing to do. So you should lower the expectation as much as you could. And I mean, well, actually, I'm just going to share with you something that I've been that I've learned over the past 1.5 years on testing, say, hypothesis or physical theories from finite data. And I should also say that this is something that some of you have heard before, so feel free to drift away, do something else if you don't find that particularly interesting. Right, so this is joint work done in collaboration with Yanbao Zhang from NTT Basic Research Lab. So if you have not met Yanbao, then this is, sorry, I beg your pardon. Right, so this is how it looks like. And the other person I would like to thank, of course, is the chairman, because he has helped to develop the software that I use for the analysis that I'm going to tell you shortly. And before I forget, I ought to also thank the funding agencies, the Ministry of Science and Technology of Taiwan, and also the National Center for Theoretical Sciences of Taiwan. So for this audience, I probably do not need too much introductions to the idea of a device-independent approach. Moreover, Belen has already said a lot about that just now. But still, I guess I should go through that at least briefly for the benefit of those who are not here just now, and also set up the notations that I'll be using. Okay, so let's just imagine a bell test. You have a source distributing, say, pairs of physical systems to some remote stations. So on one side, we have measurement devices that I'll always be using black boxes to represent. So here I have the measurement device on Alice's side, and here I have the measurement device on Bob's side. And I'm going to use these buttons to symbolically represent the different choices that I can make, that I can implement on this on the systems. Okay. So let me also label them, say X on this side and Y on the other side. And after the measurement, you get outcomes. And let me, again, for simplicity, say that the outcomes are binary, and I'm going to call them A on this side and B on this side. Okay? So the actual values that they take are not important. All right? So you can imagine that you have a setup like this. You do the experiments many, many times, and by the end of the experiments, you collected your data and you write them down on a table like this. So in the first run, you may have chosen the first measurement. So you press the buttons on the left on this side, plus one, and you observe an outcome, plus one. And on this side, you press the second button, you observe an outcome, minus one, and so on. Okay? So you have a big table like this where you recorded all this data. And if you're not interested to see how these outcomes are correlated, to what extent they are correlated, like what Belen has said in her talk, then one way would be to look at this conditional probability distributions of seeing outcome A and outcome B, like given the respective choices of measurement. Now, if you do the measurements in such a way that they are not just spatially separated, but even in a space-like separated manner, and if you buy the assumption of local causality, then you have reasons to believe that these conditional distributions would factorize in this particular form. So this is basically the thing that John was saying yesterday. Yeah, this is what happens when you believe that this could be accounted for using local common cause. Okay, but now you have kind of rule out the possibility of a direct cause because you appeal to special theory of relativity. You do them in a space-like separated manner. Right? And once you have got to this form, it's kind of trivial to see that if you now consider linear combinations of this with real numbers here in the weights of these coefficients, then this ought to be upper bounded by some real numbers that, of course, depends also on these coefficients. Okay? So this is kind of trivial observations going from this to this. But it is together what Bell realized, and this important observations that basically tells us that if you have correlations that respect the idea of local causality, then they ought to satisfy what we now call Bell inequalities. Right. And of course, then Bell went on to show that certain predictions coming from quantum theory are not compatible with this kind of constraints, meaning that if you make a good choice of source quantum states, make good choice of measurement shear, then you could replace the left-hand side of this by the prediction of quantum theory, and you can find instances whereby this is not true. Okay, so you have a violation of Bell inequalities, of course, together, this is what Bell's theorem tells you. No locally causal theory can reproduce all quantum predictions. They could reproduce certain quantum predictions, but not everything, right? Now, I guess for this audience, you probably know all this very well, and I don't think I need to emphasize the importance of this. But I think one thing that has maybe not been so well emphasized in the past is that this is actually an operational device-independent approach to physics, as Verlaine was already telling you a fair bit just now, in the sense that you see, with a simple tool like this, you have the possibility of testing against a wide class of theories without actually caring about the details of the theory, like what's happening inside the box and so on. You don't need to know any of these things. All you need to know is that you have labels for measurement choices, labels for measurement outcomes, and you collect the data, you compute this, let's say using relative frequencies, and then you can make your comparisons. So in principle, that could help you to falsify a big class of theories and so on. Okay, so the next thing that I'd like to tell you is again a repetition of what Verlaine has told you already just now, that I'm going to tell you this geometrical approach to this problem. So in particular, you have a collection of all these conditional probability distributions. So in this particular instance where you have two experimenters, each with two possible choices of measurements and two possible outcomes, we have all together 2^4 such joint conditional probability distributions. You can now just imagine that you stack them one on top of another, that gives you your vector. So in this space of probability vectors, it turns out that the set of correlation that respects the assumption of local causality is a convex polytope. So if it so happens that you don't know what this means, let me just briefly say that firstly, it's a convex set, meaning that if you take any two points from the set, then if you draw a straight line joining them, meaning that you look at convex combination of this point, they must also be members of the set. And the fact that it's a polytope simply means that it is a set with a finite number of extreme points. Okay, so there are only a finite number of these vertices. So what Bell has shown when I put it in this geometrical perspective is to say that the set of quantum distribution is a superset of the set of locally causal distributions. And here I've made use of the fact that everything that you can do in a locally causal theory, you can also do it with quantum theory. Okay, if you have not thought about this before, maybe a little exercise that's worth trying to do. Okay, so for example, if you have access to a good source in experiments, you do the right choice of measurements, you may be able to produce a correlation that sits here, and this is in the green region but outside the blue one. And usually what we do when we go to the experiments to try to certify or witness this fact is to make use of what's called Bell inequality, for example, the Clausewitz-Shumanni-Hertz Bell inequalities. And here, this notation just means the correlator, and that's just the difference between the probability of them seeing the same outcome and the probability of them seeing different outcomes. Okay? So while this was already a surprise in the 60s, and then 30 years later, another surprise came about when another set of distribution that's also very natural to consider, the so-called no-signaling set of distribution, turns out to be, again, different from the set of quantum distributions. But in this case, this is bigger and a set of quantum distributions. And a famous example of that is the so-called Popescu roulette box that sits at, again, one of these extreme points of this set. So this set is, again, a polytope, a convex polytope. It has finite number of extreme points and so on. So how is this set defined? It's basically defined by imposing on the set of legitimate distributions these equality constraints. And physically, these constraints simply say that is a set which forbids the possibility of doing superluminal communications by just exploiting the correlations alone. What do I mean by that? So if this any of this constraint was violated in a way that is independent of the spatial distance, then in principle, you could say, if I'm Bob and I could make different choices of my measurements remotely, then I'll be able to actually control the marginal distributions seen on LS sites. Okay, so with this, then in principle, because as I said, if this is true, I mean, there's a violation and this violation is in a control and manner and is independent of the spatial distance, then you can do communication remotely. And also another point that Berlin has already mentioned. So the quantum set, although it is something that can be written defined in this relatively simple manner, but it's very difficult to characterize. So we'll be using approximations of the quantum sets. So in particular, I'll be using Q tilde as a notation for the almost quantum set, and I'll be using some higher level, tighter approximations to the quantum set. Be using this this solve. So you don't need to know the details of this, except that these are better approximations to the quantum set. Okay, and for that matter, let me also say that if you go to the space of these distributions, of this scenario where you have two parties, two measurement settings, and two outcomes, then you can indeed find a slice of the set which looks exactly like this. Okay, but I should also say that this is not the typical picture that you should get out of this space. And there are many, many other funny looking things. I mean, they still satisfy all these strict inclusions, but in general, they are not as symmetrical and they are not as nice. Okay, so if you're interested to see a few examples of those, you're welcome to look into this other paper that I worked out together with Ellie and other people from Singapore and so on. Okay, so let me now come back to experimental tests of this series. Okay, and this is still more or less going to stay at the level of a cartoon. Okay, so imagine that you have done all these things, you've collected all this data. What can you do next? So you can now start counting from this table the number of times particular combinations of values of A and B given values of X and Y's appear. Okay, so you count them. So for example, the number of times class 1 appears and class 1 appears when the measurement choices are 1 and 1. You count them, maybe they give you a number like this. And you do similar countings for the other things. You can also count the number of times particular combination of measurement choices are made, and that's just given by the sum of this. And the total length of the table is the number of trials that's just given by the sum of all this. And from here, you can then work out the relative frequencies of seeing particular combinations of outcomes given particular combination of measurement choices. Just take the ratios, and you get the relative frequencies. Now, if this is done in a situation where you have a source described by some density matrix and with some local POVMs, then you can use a Born's rule to work out the quantum probabilities. And if this involves a huge number of trials in an idealized situation where every single trial looks exactly the same, it's IID, then this would give a pretty good approximation to this. Okay? And in particular, in experiments, what happens very often is that people just substitute these relative frequencies into this, and then they see a violation of the Bell-Nick. Right? And of course, in practice, something more sophisticated than that is done. I mean, there are a lot of subtleties, loopholes, and so on. I'm not going to get into any of those. But what is true is that, I guess, to a large extent, people do believe that we now have all these loophole-free Bell tests, and they confirm with high confidence that our world does not respect local causality. So why do I say with high confidence rather than saying that with certainty? And the fact is that we have only access to a finite number of trials, and anything that is not logically forbidden can happen with finite statistical fluctuation. So we can only confirm with high confidence. Okay? So to help you to appreciate this fact a little bit better, let's have a look again at these relative frequencies, which I say you can estimate by taking a ratio of this. And I say that this is pretty good approximation to the quantum distributions. I mean, good, for example, in the sense of taking the trace distance between this and you find that it's small and so on. But the fact is that this is actually generically not quantum. This relative frequencies is not quantum in the sense that you cannot find any quantum state density matrix, any local POM elements such that this holds with equality. Okay? And how do I know that this is the case? Well, in fact, I know that generically even violates the no signaling conditions. Why is that? I mean, one way for you to appreciate this fact is that in this space of probability distributions, the no signaling conditions define some kind of subspace, right, in this space. And with statistical fluctuations, you would be, you know, somewhere near the subspace to be coincide to fall exactly on this subspace. It could happen, but generically that is not going to be the case. Okay, I mean, this is just like saying that if I have a fair coin and I toss it 1,000 times, do you expect to see head 500 times and tails 500 times? This could happen, but generically, this is not going to be the case. Okay, so even though you believe that the underlying theory satisfies all this, but when you go to real data, you find that it deviates from this. Is this surprising? Of course not, because as I said, with statistical fluctuations, anything that's not logically forbidden can happen, okay, with some chance. Okay, but it does tell you that when you are going to test this hypothesis, you need to be careful, at least maybe something not obvious to naive theorists like me for a long time. I mean, in particular, you say, oh, I put this data into a Bell inequality, I see a violation. But then I look into this, but it also violates the no signaling conditions, okay? Naive violation of no signaling conditions. How do I know that, why should I be surprised that it violates the Bell inequality if it also violates the no signaling conditions? In a way, okay? Maybe you should not. I mean, for experimentalists who really know their stuff, they know that, okay, everything is under control and so on. But for naive theorists like me, it's a bit more difficult to understand all this. So that's why it got me interested into all this, and that's why I wanted to share with you something that I've learned over the past year on this. Okay, so let's take a step back. What exactly is it that we wanted to do when we are doing all this? We wanted to do hypothesis testing. We wanted to determine from the real data whether hypothesis is likely to be true. So what kind of hypothesis is of interest here? For example, the hypothesis of local causality, the hypothesis of no signaling, for instance, you look at what I say just now and say, oh, there seems to be some violation of no signaling. Maybe I should check also against the no signaling hypothesis. Or if you work in GPT, and in particular GPT that goes beyond quantum, then you might also be interested to test against the quantum hypothesis, one's true, for instance. Or maybe for some reasons you think that it ought to be something that's even more fancy than almost quantum, then you might want to test against the almost quantum as your hypothesis, or maybe some other tighter approximation to the quantum test. Okay? And one tool that is often used in hypothesis testing, or at least one tool that's getting more and more fashionable these days, is p-value. And that's basically the probability of seeing something at least as extreme as what you have observed, given that the hypothesis is true. But let me try to give you an example. Suppose that you do a trial of the experiments, I mean, let's say 1,000. Okay, maybe 1,000 is too little, let's say 1,000,000. And then you say that, let me compute the average values of CHSH Bell functionals, given that I have 1,000,000 trials. Okay, then because of finite statistical fluctuations, sometimes you could, when you do this computation, this average, end up with something that's bigger than 2. But that doesn't mean that you really have a violation of the hypothesis, because as I say, anything that's not logically forbidden can happen. But so if you make a plot of the distribution of the CHSH value, so going from minus 4 to 4, then you may see some kind of distributions like this. Then, but the fact is that if you have more and more trials, then this is more and more constrained. But with any finite number of trials, there's always a chance that you would exceed the so-called local bound. That could happen. So the p-value basically tells you what's the chance of this happening, given that the hypothesis is true, okay? So for instance, you might see a value of 2.2 in experiments, then a p-value basically tells you that what is the chance that under the hypothesis is true, I mean, in this case, local causality is true, and you see a value of 2.2 or above. So it gives you the tail probability or this area under the curve. Okay, so that's what it does. And to my understanding, one of the first person who tried to do this properly from a statistical point of view was Richard Gill. That was done like 16 years ago in a conference in Boxio. And so what he did was that basically he rewrite the CHSH inequality, not in terms of the expectation values that you normally see, but in terms of the total, the actual number of counts. Okay, so he wrote that in an expression like that. And then he worked out an expression, an inequality saying that if this value is bigger than zero, then you can upper bound the probability of the hypothesis being true. For instance, if the value of the observed value is greater than zero, let's say it's 1,000, then what you will need to do is to work out a number k so that z is greater than or equal to 1,000. Then in that case, k will be a positive number, then you can put that positive numbers onto the right-hand side. Of course, this will give rise to a number that's less than 1, okay? So with that, then you can upper bound the probability that the hypothesis is true, given those observations. So when he applied to the experimental data gathered by Gregoire Weiss and so on in 1998 with a CHSH value of 2.73, with only like 15,000 trials, then he computed, and with these expressions, a p-value bound of that, which is, I guess, very small, and I guess for most serious here, this is almost as good as zero. Okay? Of course, there were some loopholes, but I guess for many people here, you will not believe that if you have closed those loopholes, things will change significantly. So in some sense, this was already done or taken care of at that stage, like 16 years ago and so on. So why am I still doing all this? Well, firstly, this is not the only Bell inequalities that we have. There may be other Bell inequalities that are more relevant. For example, there are more resistance to detection inefficiencies and so on. And also for people here who may care about other sets, okay, like almost quantum set or whatever, this is not going to work. Okay, you need something more general than that. And for that, let me also tell you some other things that are relevant to statistical analysis. So shortly after Richard Gill presented this, then he also, together with Van Damme and other people, put up a paper and argued that actually, when you're doing all these things properly with finite trials, then you should really quantify the amount of evidence against the hypothesis using what's called the Kullback-Leibler divergence. So the idea is very simple. So you do, I mean, there are many different possibilities of Bell tests that you can do, maybe using different inequalities and so on. You can ask yourself the following questions. If I've now set the number of trials to be a fixed number, let's say I only want to do that for a million, okay, which of these tests actually gives me the highest confidence of ruling out the hypothesis? And if that is the thing that you think is a reasonable figure of merit, then you say, then you should be looking at the Kullback-Leibler divergence, and that is defined basically as follows. So what you do is that if you consider some fixed input distributions, then the divergence from, let's say, some ideal quantum distribution to the set of distributions associated with a hypothesis is done by minimizing over all members from the set these particular functions. Okay? So some small technicality here. Usually the divergence is defined with respect to unconditional distributions. Here I'm just taking for simplicity that the input distribution is the same, so this cancels out and it doesn't really matter. Right? And he then went on also to show, together with Antonio Asin and Nicolas Gisan in 2005, that if you start with this, if you now do this minimization, then the minimizer to this optimization problem can be used to construct some kind of optimized Bell inequality for the purpose of this hypothesis testing. So if you like, I can use the terminology of Berlin and say that this is some kind of normalized Bell functional, okay? And this is the one that you could use to do your test in an optimized manner. Optimized in the sense of what I've said just now. Like, if you fix a number of trials, which inequality that you should be using if you wanted to have the highest confidence of ruling out this hypothesis, then this is the one, okay? So you do this minimization, you obtain some optimum, a minimizer, so some optimum from the set, okay? From the set, and then you use that to define the coefficients of your Bell inequality. So that's just taken as the ratio of the ideal quantum distributions that you have to this optimizer. Okay? Right. And sometime last year, Denis and me and my students and so on, we also show that if you now do this kind of optimization with respect to not just the locally causal set, but let's say with respect to any other convex sets, then the minimizer is even unique. Okay? So this is something that you can show. And this idea was later picked up by Yan Bao, collaborators, and Scott Glancy and Emmanuel Neal a few years later. And now, instead of applying to an idealized quantum distribution, the thing that you work out using Born's rule, now you're going to apply that to relative frequencies. Things that you collect from the experiments, and again, you can follow basically the same procedure, and the unique minimizer will allow you to derive some kind of optimized inequalities. Okay? Assuming in a way that the distributions, the actual thing that you have, the actual source that you have is not going to deviate too much from what you have computed, what you have used to compute the relative frequencies. Okay? And what is important is that we can make this quantitative. So I say that it's optimized. You can actually use that to compute the p-value bound for the hypothesis, even in the non-IID scenario. Okay, even in a scenario where the trials actually does not fit into the idealized situations where people often assume. I mean, if you talk to experimentalists, they can easily tell you that from one trial to the other, there's drift, the temperature of the air conditioning changes, whatever. So all kinds of things can go wrong. So in a typical experimental scenario, you do not have IID situation. So it's very important that this tool would work even in a non-IID scenario. Okay, right. So there was a lot in this approach, and I'm not going to give you all the details, but if you're interested, I encourage you to look into that. What I'm going to do is that I'm going to start from this approach and kind of simplify that, tell you how to apply that in a simplified manner. It's not optimal, but it's kind of simple enough for me to appreciate. So let's say you do some initial data collections, which you can have this table that you use to compute relative frequencies, and then you do your minimization of the KL divergence, and then you obtain some kind of optimized Bell inequality, which you are going to use then to do your hypothesis testing. And it's very important that this thing that you have now derived cannot be applied to the data which you use to derive this inequality, because then you may introduce some kind of p-value hacking, which is forbidden, okay? So I'm going to use this to test some other data that I've obtained in experiments, presumably data that was obtained in a situation that's somewhat similar to when this was obtained. Then I'm going to follow some procedures, and that will allow me to upper bound p-values. And I'm going to tell you now how this procedure works, okay? So for concreteness, let me label the data to be tested, the results by RI for the IVE trial. So notice that here I say the results would include both the measurement choices and the measurement outcomes. So the measurement settings ought to be chosen randomly, and therefore they are also some kind of random variables in your experiment, and same for the outcomes. So let me just denote them by this. So R for results that involves a collection of all this. So I then define the prediction ratios, this capital R, which is a function of this little r, which is a function in turn of all this inputs and outputs at that particular trial, to be basically the values of this coefficients of this optimized inequalities, taking the values of this, the particular value of A, B, and X, and Y for that trial. So what I meant by that is that if you remember what I said earlier, for instance, here, I obtained these optimized inequalities. So this is taken as the ratio of the relative frequencies to this optimizer. Now I can write this all out in a table. So depending on the values of A, B, and X, and Y, so this is a table, let's say, of 4x4 or something like that, 16 entries. And now I did my experiments. Then I have the particular values of X, Y, and A, and B. So I can read off from the table what is the value of R in that instance, and I'll compute that. Then you can show, as they did already back in 2005, that the expectation of value of this respect to the hypothesis is upper bounded by 1 because it's some kind of normalized Bell functional. Then if you're not given a sequence of all this result, okay, all those for the data that you wanted to test, then you can define the test statistics, which is a quantity for your hypothesis testing that's defined simply by the product of all these capital R's. Then you can show that they satisfy any of these properties. So firstly, they are non-negative. This is kind of trivial because it's ratio of non-negative numbers, so it has to be non-negative. And it is something that has expectation value that is upper bounded by 1. Again, this is kind of trivial because this is upper bounded by 1. And this is a product of all this, and therefore this is also upper bounded by 1. And you can also show that it satisfies this property that the conditional expectation value is non-increasing. Okay? It's not difficult, but you just need to make use of this fact and the defining properties of this. And once you have got all these properties shown, then you can apply Markov's inequality, and that allows you to obtain a p-value upper bound, okay? Which is just given by the minimum of these two numbers. So, meaning that you take the real experimental data, you compute these numbers, then sometimes you may end up with an instance where this number actually gives you p is actually less than 1. In that case, then, if you take the reciprocal of this, you get something like, bigger than 1. And of course, it's just telling you that the p-value upper bound that you're getting from this is kind of trivial. It doesn't tell you anything, of course, because probability is, of course, upper bounded by 1. The hypothesis that the probability is true, the probability that the hypothesis is true is, of course, upper bounded by 1. In that case, you just get something trivial. But in some instances, you would end up with this thing that's actually bigger than 1, or maybe even far bigger than 1, and therefore you end up with very strong p-value bounds. Okay? Right. Okay, so in fact, if you think a bit about what I've told you, you realize that Actually, there's nothing in this analysis, in these steps that I've used, that actually says that it has to be respect to the hypothesis of local causality, or in other words, this set of locally causal correlations. You could just as well apply this to no signaling polytope. And of course, in that case, you will not be minimizing respect to the locally causal set, you'll be minimizing respect to the no signaling polytope, and you're not going to get a Bell inequality, but a Bell-like inequalities that tells you that probably you some kind of witness which you can use to test against this hypothesis. And in fact, if you think about it even a bit more, you realize that it doesn't even have to be a polytope. It can be whatever convex sets in that space, okay? And of course, the catch is that you must be able to do this steps, this optimization, but if you can do it, then in principle, everything just follows, right? So in particular, you can go back to this picture. There are many sets here that you could compute efficiently. And so you can do that respect to the local polytope for the hypothesis of local causality. You can do that respect to no signal polytope for the hypothesis of no signaling and a bunch of other things, okay? Right, so in fact, you can do that even for non-convex set. You just convexify the set and then you still will be able to do something about that. Okay, so it seems quite general, and the only catch is that you need to be able to do this optimization. And what Denny has shown, Denny and us has shown last year, was that actually this can be done for sets that emits a linear programming characterization, meaning a polytope, and also basically for whatever sets that has this kind of semi-definite programming characterization. This can be done, okay? And it can be done rather efficiently. That's also important. So let me now give you some examples to see how well this actually works, okay? So let me start by considering, let's say, a source that lies along the isotropic line. What do I mean by that? Meaning somewhere, the point that lies somewhere along this line joining the uniform distributions and PR box. And for things to be interesting, let me take a point that is somewhere near the boundary of the quantum set. Well, in that case, also the boundary of almost quantum set, let's say. Okay, and what I'm going to do is that I'm not going to take exactly this source as it stands, because that's kind of too boring. It has uniform marginals, not so interesting. I'm going to perturb this a little bit, introduce 1% perturbations of noise. And this noise is basically constructed by a random mixtures of all the extreme points of the no signaling polytope. Okay? I mean, why? For fun, okay? So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to simulate this experiment, numerically simulate this experiment. I'm considering 500 Bell experiments. And for each of these experiments, I'll consider a million trials. And what I'm going to do is that I'm going to use the first 10% of the data to do the relative frequencies and then to do the optimization with respect to the KL divergence. Then I'm going to compute the p-values for each of these experiments. And at the end, I'm going to plot the histogram of these p-values, okay? Just to give you an idea of how well it works, or at least to convince myself that I know how it works, right? So specifically, let me start by considering something that's a little bit outside. And even after this mixing, it is still outside the set. And the p-value bounds that I have in that case, well, not surprisingly, if I test that against no signaling hypothesis, I basically only end up with trivial p-value bounds. Nothing to suggest that the hypothesis violated. But if I test that against some relaxation of the quantum sets, then you'll find that indeed for a significant fraction of the instances, I do have actually a very low p-value, less than 0.02. Okay, usually the cutoff that people use to say that this is actually a good conclusion, for instance, right? So this is what happens with this particular choice. And what happens if I move this a little bit nearer to the boundary of the set? Let's say I move that so that P naught exactly sits on the boundary. And if I now introduce a bit of perturbations, then it turns out that it's actually inside the green region. Okay, in that case, again, not surprisingly, you find that there's nothing that really conclusively tells me that the hypothesis, there's a problem with the hypothesis. Although you see that there are sometimes some bumps, little bumps, also for small p-values. And I guess that's really telling you a subtlety in applying all these things, because sometimes you might have heard people criticizing the usage of p-values in that, well, this sucks or whatever. I mean, as I say, anything that's not logically forbidden can happen. So it could also happen that for that particular run, you are unfortunate enough that you end up with some small p-values. This could happen, okay? So that's why I'm not just plotting one p-value, but the histograms of this, to give you an idea of how well this could work. So this is for the IID case and IID source. Now I'm just going to give you some examples of non-IID source. So similarly, first I consider a p-naught that lies along this line, and then I'm going to perturb this, but now this perturbation is going to vary from one trial to the other. So for this 1 million trials, every time I introduce a different perturbation. Okay, and then I use that as my source to generate my data for that particular trial, and I'm going to do the same things. Do 500 sets of experiments, I sacrifice part of data to do the optimizations, then I compute p-value bounds for the remaining data. And here's the histogram for this particular case. And you see that again, I'm able to pick up many of these instances where the source is actually outside the set that I care about. And if I now consider also the case where it sits on the boundary, then things get a lot more subtle. I do not have really strong evidence showing that it is not working, that is working, that is outside the set. I mean, there are instances where it will be outside the sets because, as I say, this is perturbed in a way that is different from one trial to the other. So sometimes I'll be mixing with, say, another PR box, and they will be outside the set. But you see that I do not have strong enough evidence to show that in this kind of analysis. So, of course, this can also happen when you're near to the boundary, everything gets tricky. Okay, so let me now show you, I mean, this were all done with numerical simulations. Let me now show you examples of this applied to real data. And that is basically what got me into Aldridge. So some of you might have seen me presenting these pictures. Maybe Lev has seen this in India. So this consent experiment that I did together with Paul Kriyat's group back in 2015, at that time, what we were interested to do is to scan the boundary of the quantum set in this slice. And you see that here, we picked a particular size of the quantum set, and we have performed experiments with 180 data points scattered around the circle. So the boundary of the quantum set is this circle, and you see that indeed all these points lines pretty much on the circle, and that seems to suggest exceptionally well agreement with quantum predictions. Okay, well, is that really the case? We can take a closer look into this, and here I'm plotting you, showing you the results for each of these data points. So let me give you a bit of explanation of this. So I'm using the angle here, theta, to label each of these different points here. So theta is the angle measured from the horizontal axis in a counterclockwise direction. So for example, theta equals to 60 degree pi on 3 corresponds to this particular data point. And what I have on the vertical axis is the difference between what is allowed in theory, what is the maximum value of that particular Bell inequality in theory, and what we actually measure experimentally. So you would expect that in an experimental situation, it's noisy, it's lossy, and therefore to get to anything that is close to what is allowed by the theory is usually like daydreaming. But at the same time, you know that there are finite statistics, there can be finite statistical fluctuations. Maybe there are some times where you can get outside the boundary, okay? So it's not so clear. Indeed, in the experiments, we have 8 data points here that actually show that the measure value exceeds the theoretical value as predicted by quantum theory. So as a naive theorist, I was very excited to see this. I was thinking, maybe there's something that interesting that I could learn out of all this. But of course, my experimentalist collaborators, they were not at all as enthusiastic as me. And they did some computations, and they convinced themselves that it's fine. So the p-values of seeing 8 out of 180 data points that exceeds the quantum boundary is like 66% or something like that. So for them, it's all good. Well, for me, I didn't understand how the analysis is done because there seems to be a lot of assumptions that went into that calculations. They assume, for example, that the real mean radius, okay, I mean, you can see this as corresponding to different radius of the circle, and the mean radius of this is exactly the one that we measure in experiments and so on. There are a bunch of assumptions that I do not see myself how to justify them. So it was very happy that I learned how to do this analysis in a more or less device independent way, that I don't need to care about any of these things. I just need to look at the data and do the analysis, okay? But I don't really have access to the original data, okay, like the actual results for the individual trials. What I have access to is the total number of counts for each particular combinations of the measurements. okay, for each of these different sets of experiments. So what I do is that I take each of this as my initial data collections, and then I do compute the relative frequencies. I use that to compute the optimized inequality and apply to the neighboring set of data, okay, in order not to introduce the possibility of p-value hack. Okay, but as you can imagine, this is far from optimal, because if I had access to the real data, I would be able to do better than that. I did not. Okay, in any case, I'm going to show you some results out of this analysis. So firstly, among those 8 anomalous sets of data, if I did the hypothesis gains no signaling, I see a p-value bound, which is like 10 to the minus 6. This is small, I think you will agree. And if I did that against a quantum, then this is of the order of 10 to the minus 8. And what came even as a bigger surprise to me was that when I tried to do the analysis for the whole set of data rather than just to single zoom into those 8 set of anomalous values, I had something of the order of 10 to the minus 55. And this is much worse to compare with 10 to the minus 27, as I was saying earlier, respect to the 1998 experiment. Okay, so to put this in the same way that I presented it for the other set of data, numerical data, this is what I get for the histogram. I'm not seeing things like a peak here with maybe little bumps there, but actually I'm seeing a lot of these instances where the p-value is very small. Okay? What does that mean? Am I seeing violation of no signaling? Well, unfortunately not quite, because I learned on hindsight that the experimentalists did not randomize the measurement setting, which is one of the things that I need in this analysis, because the measurement choices were treated as random variables, but they were not. They were collected in bulk, which is actually what happens very frequently in many of these Bell tests. So for convenience, they just fix the settings, measure, for a significant portion of time, and then move on to the next. So they didn't randomize the settings. Okay? In any case, I hope you're not too disappointed with how this story ends. I mean, at the end of the day, I just wanted to share with you something that I've learned in this little exercise. But there are some possible take-home messages, which is that firstly, there seems to be a rather general way for doing this kind of hypothesis testing if your hypothesis can be associated with some convex sets of correlations. And for that to work, the convex sets is something that hopefully the membership is something that can be tested using semi-definite programs or linear programs, for instance. On a more skeptical side, I would say that actually I've also learned something interesting out of all this, which is that there are sometimes unexpected features of the experiments, and this can be easily overlooked if you do not do the proper statistical analysis. And in some sense, when I say this, I'm making an assumption, which is that more or less, the same set of data can be observed should they have randomized the settings. Okay? I guess many of you would probably think that this is not too bad an assumption. I mean, if you believe that if I have now randomized the settings, I will not be able to get that set of data, well, that feels to me like there's some kind of conspiracy. So maybe it is indeed impossible to see that kind of data should they have randomized the settings, because then they'll have to do the experiment for a much longer period of time, it's not stable, and so on. Possible, I don't know. But on the other hand, it seems to show some kind of apparent violation of no signaling conditions. And sometimes it is actually useful, for example, in this context, to identify some possible issues in the setup. Like, on hindsight, then I realized that, looking at the data, I said that, well, something is strange here. Then, after discussing with them, then I realized that, okay, they didn't randomize the setting. So that is a problem, okay, if you wanted to do a real Bell test. Okay, so this is, of course, not a new idea per se. For example, same kind of idea was also proposed by Smania and people like Matthias Kleiman, Adán Cabello, and Mohamed Biruneau, who were involved in this work. So I think I've spoken maybe a bit too much, and I'll end here, and thank you very much for your attention.
I'm sure this will generate a lot of questions.
Yes, Rob. Yes.
Regarding the randomization of the settings.
Yes.
So are you suggesting that because they didn't randomize the settings, there was in fact some sort of information that propagated from one side of the experiment to the other, informing it of which setting was in place? Because
no.
So then why does not randomizing the settings lead you to expect
violations
in a signaling, for example?
No, so I guess what I'm saying is that the analysis that I've done only makes sense if the settings was randomized. So the entire analysis did not make sense because I made the wrong assumption that they randomized with a uniform distribution of settings. So I cannot, you know, draw conclusions directly from these histograms that I show you because the analysis didn't make sense. But of course, you could ask the following questions, like, could more or less the same set of data be observed, at least in principle, should they have randomized the set? I would be tempted to say yes. And in that case, you could imagine that the whole analysis is repeated. Maybe you see the same kind of distributions for the p-values. So what is that telling us? My understanding of that is that then, well, there seemed to be strong evidence against the hypothesis of no signaling in that case. But the problem may not be in a strict sense that there is some kind of signaling happening, but maybe there are other problems in the setup. But what I know is that, say, a systematic drift of the setup is not good enough to explain the problem because the tool that I have here would also work for a non-IID scenario. So it could tolerate that. So even if you have a kind of systematic drift, it's not going to be good enough to explain why you have small p-values for those hypotheses. So there must be something else, but you cannot go back a few years ago to find what exactly was wrong. Yes, Danny?
I have a couple of questions, right? Do you know how many blocks they took of the data, like all the settings 00, then all 01, then 10, then 11, and they don't go back to 00? Or they do that?
Well, it's actually even more, in some sense, even worse than that, because they have, if I remember correctly, like a single detector. So for all the 16 probabilities, they have to do that, like, do like 16 times rather than, you know, fix the measurements, then you obtain both outcomes at the same time. It counts for both outcomes. So they have to do that for this outcome, for the other outcome, and so on. Yes, left.
Just good. Well, maybe you can take the data and put randomization by hand and look at it again.
I don't have all the details of the data. I only have like consolidated information, like what's the total number of counts. I don't have the, yes. I would have done that if I had access to that, yes.
Are there remaining questions?
Yes.
I'm trying to formulate a question. I'm trying not to. So there's some sense in which you have to do this, you have to look at finite data sets.
Yes.
And probabilities, at least so far as experiments are concerned, are a kind of convenient fiction.
Yes.
Does working in this way give you any sort of fundamental insights into how one might better formulate physical theories without, for example, probabilities? Have you had?
Well, no, not in any real sense. But I mean, I guess what I would say is that, I mean, when we did this work with Paul, So on the one hand, we wanted to see how far we can push ourselves, how far we could push ourselves experimentally towards the limits allowed by quantum theory. And of course, there's some chance, I don't know how that could possibly happen, but there's some chance that if you're near to the boundary, then maybe you could also see something interesting. So in that sense, it might give you some hints, but not with the data analysis themselves. Although in a way this is kind of ridiculous to think about because you say that, well, I follow the prescriptions given by quantum theory to tell me what I do in the lab, and then how could I possibly go beyond that? Well, in theory, no, it's not possible. But in experiments, it is a very different deal. Who knows? So in some sense, I think what the tools offer is, for me at least, a cleaner way to actually test this hypothesis as opposed to a bunch of other things that you have to put in, like you have to add this assumption and that assumption, and then you compute some p-values, which I don't really know what that means. So as far as I'm concerned, when we wanted to do this kind of test, then it would seem to make a lot of sense to try to keep that device independent. And who knows, maybe eventually, maybe someone has other fancy theories that really tells you the prescription of what you can try to do in the lab, and then maybe that would serve, again, as a useful tool for that kind of purpose. Yes, Ali?
The Delta inequalities that you optimize using sort of your initial data, are they faster defining Bell inequalities?
You mean the Bell inequality that I obtained out of this optimization?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Generically, I would not expect it to be. I mean, I didn't even look into that. Yeah. I think it's kind of important to realize that they are, you know, there are many different. So if you have a convex set, you have a point outside the set, then of course you can draw maybe many different hyperplanes to separate them. And there are, some of them are optimum in the sense that the distance is the largest. They measure by the value of the violations. But these are usually and not necessarily the optimal one with respect to statistical strength in terms of KL divergence. They are usually not. So for example, in a paper by Richard Gill and Van Damme and so on, they compare quite a few different tests, like CHSH, the GSZ test, and a bunch of these other things. So in that particular case, in say the simplest scenario, it turns out that CHSH is indeed pretty good, but GSZ is better in some sense. Like you need to take 4 times less in terms of the number of data that you need to achieve the same level of statistical confidence, and so on. I'm not aware of any real systematic study after what they have done back in 2005.
Any other questions?
Yes?
So this is a slightly broad question, but in the same vein of the motivation, which is if you have finite data, then you can see violations of
whatever
violations. Of,
yeah.
So like here, there you have no signaling constraints in this setup, but if you had protocols where you had communication capacity bounded. So some part of the protocol
yes.
is non-signaling, but some
yes.
part of the protocol, like you can think of density mm-hmm. or teleportation. Like what would the implications?
So that's a very good question. So for instance, if you allow bounded communication, let's say, I don't know, 1 bit of communication, then you could show that, well, let's say, 1 bit of communication on top of shared randomness, then, I mean, there have been work showing that you still have some kind of polytope. You still have some kind of convex set, so basically, you can still do it. As long as you have an explicit characterization of the set, in one way or another.
Any other questions? Are we all ready to go to lunch before we leave the same of the gathering?
Thank you.